Good evening, Ian.
Have you finished your Christmas shopping yet?
Are you for real? I've barely started.
Well, my producer Sophie has actually done everything. Can you believe it was the 23rd of November, and she's actually finished her Christmas shopping. I haven't even really thought about Christmas at all, and I very rarely do until the 23rd of December.
Oh, well, I have thought about Christmas, and I did have a little mulled cider drinks do last night because it was the turning on of the lights in Great Malvern. And I have got a hanging basket with little lights around it outside my front door. And I have bought a few presents in the, you know, I have succumbed to the capitalist nightmare that is Black Friday.
Have you? I haven't at all. Were you invited to switch on the lights as the local celebrity?
No, they didn't need me, mate. They got Sue Pollard.
Heidi, hi.
She is appearing in our local panto, and she turned on our lights.
Oh, no, she isn't.
Behind you.
Do you know, who was I talking to the other day? And I did think that when all of my career is over, I'd quite fancy appearing in panto, because if Anne Widdecombe can do it, she's appearing in Reigate, by the way. I don't know. Probably as Widder's Twanky, I imagine. You and I could do a double act in a pantomime, couldn't we?
What, the Ugly Sisters?
No, I could be Buttons and you could be... No, Buttons has to be played by a woman, though. I've always thought that was a bit weird.
Buttons is played by a man, I think, isn't it?
No, it's not. No. Buttons is always played by a sort of slightly willowy-looking woman.
Oh, is this Cinderella Buttons?
Yeah.
Cinderella? I think Buttons is played... Oh, I don't...
Well, I'll be Prince Charming.
All this gender fluidity, it's, you know, it's too complicated for me.
It's very, very, very confusing, isn't it?
These young people.
So we're only really going to talk about one subject yet again. Actually, we do have a few other subjects to whet people's appetite. Like we want to talk about Boris spraying with water, I should add, because the water cannon have been... So in fact, why don't we start off with that? Rather than talk about Brexit, which everybody's talking about that, let's talk about Boris's water cannon. They've been sold by Sadiq Khan. Boris paid £330,000 for them. They've never been used. They've never really been licensed because Theresa May wanted to play silly buggers with it. Sadiq sold them for 11 grand.
Along with the garden bridge, the airport on the island, or whatever it bloody well was. This is yet another example of Boris's grandiose, ridiculously arrogant schemes, which in this case has cost Londoners 300 grand for something that, I mean, the reason why Theresa May didn't license them is because it was wholly out of keeping with a British model of policing to think that you were going to, on the streets of London, water cannon people off. You know, it's not like looking this weekend at what's gone on in France and the way in which they've responded to the protests there. That's the type of approach to riots that the French police would be more likely to use. It is not part of our British way of policing, and the fact that he ever bought them in the first place shows how ludicrously out of touch he is.
The thing is, Sadiq sold them at exactly the wrong time, because they could have been deployed on these ridiculous people who have been blocking the bridges this week.
What is that protest about? I haven't been in London this week.
It's obviously had a massive impact on you. It's something to do with climate change. I kept telling all of our travel reporters that we shouldn't even be bothering to report it because it just gives them publicity. But they said, we are actually here to tell people that bridges are blocked and they need to find an alternative route.
But it sounds like quite an important issue, to be fair, Ian, the type of thing that I may well have protested about in my time.
No, this type of thing that when you were Home Secretary, you would have been Jackboot Jackie on.
I'd have kettled them without a second thought.
Exactly. But he sold them at such a low price. And I had somebody text me when I was talking about this on the radio, should we say a rather rich friend of mine. I had the old one, you know. And they said, well, I would have paid more than 11 grand for them. Why didn't he advertise them? So there may be a National Audit Office inquiry into the value for money for the taxpayer for this, both on Boris's part and Sadiq's. But there we go.
Sadiq's got better things to do than go round trying to find the highest bidder for a totally useless lot of water cannon. And, you know, your friend presumably wouldn't have got license to use them if they'd wanted to use them in this country. So it's all very well to say, you know, I'd pay this amount of money, but I just think Sadiq did the best thing he could, getting rid of the white elephant.
Well, you're right, he has got better things to do, like develop a knife crime policy, for example, which he's singularly incapable of doing.
Which he has done successfully.
Oh, really? That would be why so many people have been stabbed in the last 2 weeks.
Which is obviously tragic, and as he's been clear, what he's doing is he's actually trying to take a longer-term strategic approach, necessary anyway, but certainly the only thing possible when police numbers have been totally slashed by this government's austerity policy. And we're now seeing chief constables across the country coming out and being clear about the impact that that's having on their ability to police. So it's not just about London and Sadiq. It's about 20,000 fewer police officers and nearly 20,000 fewer police staff as well.
Can I just thank you for saying fewer rather than less? Because you would have incurred my wrath if you'd said less.
And anybody who doesn't say fewer incurs my wrath, yes. I have a special mug that I'm going to give to a few people this Christmas as well. And it's a grammar mug and it says on it, fewer sugar cubes and less milk.
Very, very good. Where'd you get those from? I need to buy some.
It's from that literary gifts company.
Because I quite like that.
It's not that bloody difficult.
And don't start a sentence with so.
It's a good job that there's somebody maintaining standards in this country, me and you, Ian.
Quite, you and I.
Was that right, me and you?
No. Oh, you were doing so well. And didn't you used to teach English?
No, I taught economics and business studies.
Oh, did you? Right.
Yeah, that's why I'm constantly besting you on economics, Ian.
Beasting me? Oh, no, that's something different.
No, that's something else.
It started. Somebody sent a question in saying, I haven't actually got a question, but can we have more smut, please? But I'm not really feeling in the mood for smut this week, so I'm not sure that you're going to get an awful lot.
I'm not going to get much from you, Ian.
No, quite. Right, let's move on to Brexit, because we are recording this at 4:15 on Sunday afternoon. We'd normally do it a little bit earlier, but I thought it was probably best to do it later in the day so we knew exactly what had happened in Brussels. And the answer is actually not an awful lot. They signed the deal. It was the deal everyone expected. There was no last-minute tinkering. Gibraltar was the only real fly in the ointment that could have sort of scuppered it. And yet again, Theresa May capitulated. So, or did she?
I think she did, didn't she? I mean, the Gibraltarian politicians seem to be pretty unhappy about the fact that she had now conceded the fact that Spain could discuss with the UK any plans for the future of Gibraltar. I'm going to say something that means I'll never be able to visit Gibraltar now. I don't feel particularly strongly about Gibraltar and their relationship with Spain. I mean, I think if they want to stay as part of the UK as an overseas territory, they should be able to. But I don't think allowing Spain to discuss their future, given that they have, you know, they are their closest neighbour, is really a massive sellout, is it?
Well, I find this one difficult to judge, because I don't believe that just because we wrote a letter to the Spanish government, that doesn't automatically mean that we've capitulated. But I actually, from what I've read, I cannot make up my mind whether I think we have or not.
That's the trouble with us. We never have any opinions on anything, do we?
Given the capitulation on virtually everything else, I'm tempted to think that they probably have, but that might be slightly unfair. Have you ever been to Gibraltar?
I have never been to Gibraltar.
No, nor have I. But your government, I seem to remember from Peter Haynes' memoirs, which I published, essentially were about to concede a joint sovereignty over Gibraltar, but somehow the Spanish at the last minute pulled out. Do you remember that?
That's interesting. No, I don't remember that. And of course, I don't know if you can make a sort of analogy between them, but that's quite tricky given the very strong position that people have always taken on the Falkland Islands, for example, where I don't think people would countenance that. Can you imagine if the Argentinians said, can we have a joint sovereignty agreement?
I think it is slightly different, but I think because the Falklands War was in our collective lifetimes, so it's one of my first political memories, I suppose, I think we all feel a little bit attached to the Falklands in a way that, I think you're right. Gibraltar has never been quite at the forefront of our minds.
You are absolutely right, Ian, though, that although we've left this podcast until the end of the day, we could just as easily have done it at 9 o'clock this morning, or probably actually yesterday, because everything went exactly as it was expected. The withdrawal agreement, the legal thing, was signed. There's approval, presumably, of the political agreement about the sort of parameters for the future debate. Nobody threw too much of a spanner into the works, because essentially this is like just merely the curtain raiser for what is going to be 2 or 3 weeks of British politics, which will be like nothing else we have ever experienced, I suggest, because, you know, 27 EU countries may well have approved this deal, but there ain't no way, as far as I can see at the moment, that this is going to get the approval of Parliament. So we'll be into a whole new time then.
Well, let's come on to that in a second. But first of all, you were away when they published the political declaration. It had been 7 pages long last weekend. It then became 27 pages. And for the first time ever, I have to say, I agreed with virtually every word that Jeremy Corbyn said in his response to Theresa May, because it is a giant wish list. There's no legal standing for this political declaration. They might as well have not bothered. They could have written it 2 years ago, frankly. It is an absolute giant wish list. And, I mean, if it all happened like that, or most of it happened like that, I suppose everyone would be quite pleased. But there's no way that it's going to. And I can foresee...
Isn't the reason why it's a giant wish list that we went into this process of negotiation 2 years ago with a whole range of sort of tough talk about how we weren't going to separate out the different parts of the negotiation. We weren't going to pay any money either. And the first thing, one of the first things we capitulated on was this, you have to do one bit before you're able to do another bit. So the reason there isn't more detail in the political declaration is, for reasons that I can't understand, they apparently can't negotiate the legal detail of it until we've actually left the EU. So that's our fault that we're in that position.
Well, I totally agree with you. And it's actually Theresa May's fault, because I know for a fact that David Davis did not want to capitulate on that, and he was ordered to by Theresa May. So, I mean, that I suppose could have been the first time that he could have resigned, but that would have been literally within a few weeks of her becoming Prime Minister. So, look, you and I aren't going to disagree on the fact that these negotiations have been grossly mishandled from beginning to end. But as I say, very profoundly, we are where we are, and we have to go from here. Now, then, I think you're absolutely right. I remember I was in San Francisco when Black Wednesday happened, and I remember thinking at the time, even though I wasn't in the country, I had this profound sense of things are not quite going to be the same again. And I have this sense now that this is the next 2 or 3 weeks are going to be quite cataclysmic. They could be cataclysmic for Theresa May, but then we've said that several times over the last few months. But they could also be cataclysmic for her whole government, because I think there is a growing sense that no one knows where we go from a no vote on December the 12th or whenever it is. And you won't have seen this, but Newsnight called me on Wednesday and said, oh, can you come on tonight? We want to talk about what happens if Parliament votes down the deal. And I said, well, look, being completely honest, I haven't got a clue. So if you're looking for sort of intelligent words, you're not probably going to get many from me. And they said, well, no, nobody knows, but we want to do a whiteboard thing. My heart slightly sank. Anyway, I went on and did it. And at the end, I sort of said, look, I think what will happen is that the opposition will call a confidence vote in Theresa May. Theresa May will win it. But then I don't know what happens after that. I would have thought that she either, even though she wins a confidence vote, this is the major plank of her government. She is putting everything on this. She's written this letter, which we'll come on to. She's going to obviously go around the country trying to sell this deal. An impossible task, in my view. If you look at the opinion polls, if you look at the number of Tory MPs that say they're going to vote against it, I can see no way that she can do that. Now, to have staked everything on this, I would have thought means that if she doesn't get the vote through, she would by definition have to resign. I mean, she doesn't have to, there's no constitutional reason for her to, but you would have thought it was such an important thing that she would certainly have to consider it. And in the interviews that she's done, she certainly has never said, well, I'm not going to resign if it doesn't go through. And you can imagine her just sort of trying to grind on in the same way that she has done many times over the last 2 years, I suppose.
What do you think about this idea that some people are suggesting that there could be a second parliamentary vote? So you have the position whereby essentially the deal is defeated. People go away, and I mean, I believe the Europeans, incidentally, the other EU members, when they say they're not going to renegotiate this deal, but people go away. There's a sort of twin strategy of one, trying to get some more words or a bit more clarification or something else in the around the agreement. On the other hand, there is an enormous whipping and sort of organisation operation to try to bring people around. And third strand, there is chaos in the markets, and the whole thing becomes people begin to fear for the future of the UK on the basis of what's happening. And of course, Philip Hammond didn't refuse to suggest that that might happen. Sort of tortuous way of expressing it.
Just on the markets thing, whoever it was that leaked that that might be a strategy to almost cause chaos in the markets, they've completely undermined the whole strategy, if indeed there was such a strategy, which I would hope there wasn't, because the markets will have discounted this, because the markets will know that this vote is going to be defeated. So I may be proved wrong, but I don't see the actual act of that vote that happening, and then the markets open at 7 o'clock the next morning and the pound drops by 5 cents and who knows. I don't really think that is possible. I think that there would be some market reaction, but it can't be any worse than it was on Black Wednesday, can it?
Well, it was pretty but that was pretty catastrophic.
Well, it was, and that, yeah. We are still in some ways that actually, I would say, was the start of the Brexit movement. In you could trace it back to that. I suppose you could trace it back before that. But I think that's when a lot of people really thought, well, do we want to stay part of this organisation?
And it was certainly the point at which it became clear that we were likely to get a Labour government. And
yes.
Yeah.
That did. And that, you see, history, politics is always cyclical, isn't it? And I think if people feel that the Conservatives have buggered up Brexit, and there's a growing feeling, I think, among the electorate that that is the case, they could be out of power for quite some time. Now, Theresa May's strongest card here is the prospect of a Jeremy Corbyn-led Labour government. If Tony Blair was still leader of the Labour Party, Labour would be 20 points ahead in the polls. I have absolutely no doubt about that. And people think, there are lots of people who are enthusiastic about Jeremy Corbyn. Well, even with the shambles of a government, Labour still can't get more than 1 or 2 points ahead in the polls. The Conservatives are still generally polling around 40%, and Labour are around 40%, but can't seem to get much over that. Now, they haven't actually played all the Jeremy Corbyn fear stuff. It didn't do so well in the last election, but it might do better this time. I don't know. But, I mean, how would the markets react to the prospect of a Labour government? I mean, again, we are in completely uncharted territory here. And I think if either of us tried to set out a sort of four things that are going to happen after December the 12th, I think we'd be probably proved wrong on all of them. But I can't see a second vote happening. What would it be on?
Well, it could be what it would be is the Parliament having voted, and Parliament then supposedly taking control. Never been quite sure how that works. The government actually goes away, and as I say, brings back a few concessions, because that's what you always have to do to win a vote. Do this operation, as I say, to try and bring people round, and then you vote again, because actually you need to find a way through this whole situation, assuming that you don't want either a no deal. And I know that there are actually now lots of people, and I think you're one of them, who would prefer a no deal to this particular deal, or a route through to a people's vote and a third referendum, as I like to think about it. I mean, don't you think that that is, I know you don't want it, but don't you think that is much more likely to happen now?
I always think it's less likely to happen now. I can see a general election happening in January, maybe. I can't really see a path to another referendum, because I don't think there's not a parliamentary majority for it.
How do we get to a general election? Why do, for the reasons that you've stated, Why? Because they were going into this general election having buggered up Brexit with a, I mean, I don't think the opposition has got a particularly coherent position, but with a, you know, reasonably strong opposition. Why would any Tory MP or Theresa May or anybody who was even the leader if Theresa May had gone, why would anybody risk that?
It's a good question, and I don't know the answer to it, but there are some times in politics where you have to bow to the inevitable, I think, and it may be that that's the only way out. I can't see Theresa May calling another referendum.
Would you rather have a general election than another referendum?
It's not really a case of what you'd rather have, isn't it? I think constitutionally, a general election would be more constitutionally correct than another referendum. Another referendum, it's just, I don't know why people call it a people's vote. It's actually a loser's vote. The only motivation that people have for another referendum is because they lost the first one and they think they could possibly win a second one. Now, I don't know what you think, but I think the most likely result of a second one, partly because of the way the EU has behaved, it is for a slightly increased Leave vote. That's what I think. I've got no way of proving that, obviously. And in that case, you go through all of the pain of the first one again. You have a country that's even more divided. And then what happens if it does come a sort of 51-49 Remain vote? I think the consequences of that, people haven't really thought about.
I think they are uncertain and are potentially unpleasant, but I think people have thought that is the least of the potential ways forward. Because if you think the country is better served by remaining in the EU, in one way of thinking about it is, what have you got to lose by having another vote?
Because well, that's an argument for having an annual vote, isn't it?
Politics is already toxic. People are already highly dissatisfied about, you know, people don't think they're getting what they voted for. That's the problem. They voted for a Brexit, which was ill-defined, but I don't think anybody thought it was what's in this deal. They didn't think, oh, we're going to be leaving the EU, but we're still going to be subscribing to all those rules. Oh, but we're not going to be able to have a say in them. That's exactly what people didn't want to happen. So they're not getting the Brexit that they want. Potentially they're getting an extraordinarily damaging no deal. So why wouldn't people want to express their view again at that point? Why wouldn't that be a legitimate thing to do? And if you're a Remainer, why wouldn't you think, oh, bloody hell, worth a shot? Because actually things are pretty horrific at the moment.
Just from a timetable point of view, it can't work. Because you would have to have all the legislation in place. The Electoral Commission then has to have 3 months to work out the question or questions. I mean, who knows what it would be? So that couldn't happen before the 29th of March. So you'd then have to withdraw Article 50, which I suspect is the real agenda of most of those leading this campaign in the first place, because that would then delay Brexit. So Conservatives...
Even if you had a general election, Ian, let's say you had a general election, you elected a Labour government, they go back to Brussels to try to renegotiate the deal with a mandate from the British people to do that, because they've been elected in a general election, then you would also have to extend the time period, wouldn't you, in order to enable that negotiation to happen. And presumably the EU would be willing to do that. They're not going to say to a newly elected government, no, sorry, we negotiated it with the old
one.
I'm not sure you would have to
do that, because I mean, the earliest a general election could happen would be the middle of January, I would say. So 2.5 months before we leave. Now, it's possible that a newly mandated government could go to, whether it's Conservative or Labour, actually, because as long as both parties had a clear vision in their manifestos for what should happen, they could easily go back to Brussels and say, well, we stood on this manifesto. This is what the British people have wanted. So we do wish to reopen this. Now, I don't know what the European Union would say then. I mean, we'd be a bit of a laughing stock, but then in some ways we already are.
Yeah.
So I think also what few people seem to have cottoned on to yet is it doesn't, from a parliamentary point of view, whatever amendments are put down on December the 12th and however many of them get passed, they actually mean nothing. This is not a meaningful vote in the way that I think some people thought it was, because according to Sir David Natsir, the Clerk of the House of Commons, These votes can, I mean, they can say Parliament has expressed a wish, but it doesn't affect the legislation. The only way that things can actually be changed in terms of leaving the European Union is for new legislation to be introduced. And I don't think that's really possible at this stage. On Tuesday, the European Court of Justice issues its findings on whether Article 50 can actually be withdrawn. So that's going to be quite interesting.
Indeed. Well, we've taught ourselves to the same position that we were at the beginning, which is that bloody well don't know.
What do you make of Theresa May's letter that she's published today?
Well, what else have you got to do when you're faced with a bunch of ferrets in a sack, which is her parliamentary party, than to appeal over their heads to the British people? I mean, I think it's, I don't know if it'll work, but it's as good a tactic as any at this particular point in time. I think there is a feeling amongst the British people that, oh, just get on with it, and you know, you lot are all arguing amongst yourselves and we just want to get it done. So it appeals to that. I think Theresa May has probably got more support amongst the British people, sort of grudging support, than most of those around her making her life difficult have got, because people sort of think, oh, well, you know, at least she's still standing, she's trying, she looks reasonably decent. So, you know, why not?
She's also, according to one poll I saw, completely turned around the women's vote in that last 2 weeks ago, Labour were leading by 6 points with women. When this poll came out, I think it was Monday or Tuesday, she was leading by 6 points. And I think you're right. There is a feeling out there that she's doing her best. Let her get on with it. But in the end, to what effect? You look at the polling on this particular deal, and all the ones I've seen show very few people in favour of it, sort of 15-20%. I know you can't take any notice of Twitter polls at all, but one of my colleagues did a Twitter poll on LBC last night, and that came out 15-85, which is in line with all of the professional polls. So I think if you write a letter and there is a general feeling in the country that it is a good deal, and what are all these MPs going on about, fine. But that's not the feeling of the country if the polls are right.
The interesting thing about that is, you know, in polling, you need to ask what your view about something is, but then you also need to ask what significance does that have to you. And I would hazard completely, you know, I would reckon in a male way that for lots of people, they actually aren't interested in the detail of the deal. They're interested in Brexiting through whatever route possible, and that therefore, if they think that people are trying to stymie Theresa May from being able to do that, they will be on her side without really getting into the detail of what the deal says. Now, I think that's because, you know, frankly, I mean, I have to confess, I still haven't read the 500 pages, but, you know, people like me and you think it's quite interesting what the detail of this deal is. The vast majority of the, you know, I was at lunch with members, highly educated, politically interested members of my family today, saying, I can't stand anymore, I turn off the news when Brexit comes on, you know, just get on with it. That type of feel, I think, is pretty widespread in the country.
You have a family of Bobs, bored of Brexit.
Yes, we have a country of Bobs, don't we?
what do you think of the view? And maybe look at this from an ex-Chief Whip's angle. If I were running the strategy on trying to get MPs to support this vote, and I was targeting predominantly Brexit-supporting MPs, the argument that I would use is the argument that Michael Gove uses, saying, well, look, let's just get out. Make sure we get out on the 29th of March, and we can deal with everything else after that. Just hold fast. Now, if I was an MP, that is probably the only argument that would appeal to me to try and make me vote for this deal. It probably wouldn't succeed, but I could have some sympathy with that. Whereas all the other arguments, I have no sympathy with whatsoever.
I think that's the I think you're absolutely right. I think that's the strongest argument. I think that's what the whips will be saying to people. Presumably, that's what the reason for Theresa May saying, you know, there are three alternatives here: no deal, deal, or no Brexit was. It's what most people, most of their, given what I just said, I suspect it's what most of their constituents will be saying to them, so they can justify it to their constituents. And they hold their nose and vote for the thing that gets us out on the 29th of March next year. And they keep open the possibility of solving the problems. I mean, dishonestly, because quite a few of them would not be soluble after we left, but they keep open the idea that you can solve the problems in ongoing discussions. That's the disadvantage with this way through as well, that it opens up all sorts of potential arguments that will be going on for years to come, so that you won't see the back of Brexit by voting for this deal. You'll just see the next stage of the negotiation, as we've already discussed. But I mean, Michael Gove's in an interesting position, isn't he? We talked last week about those who've chosen to leave the cabinet and those who've chosen to stay. He must presumably believe his staying in the cabinet and being able to make those sorts of arguments, and things like, I noticed he had a story, there was a story that clearly had come from him in the Mail on Sunday today about a no deal Brexit, meaning that within days we wouldn't have any drinking water because the chemicals that...
I mean, have you ever heard anything so ridiculous?
Well, I mean, there will be a load of shit hitting the fan, Ian, if we leave the EU without a deal. You know, I was looking at some stuff about the security provisions that we have. You know, let's not forget, if we leave without a deal, we have no European arrest warrant. All Good. Of a sudden, every bad guy in Europe thinks, oh, I'm going to go to the UK because they ain't going to be able to get me out of there very quickly. We have no ability to access
How on earth do you come to that conclusion? Just because we wouldn't have a European arrest warrant, that doesn't mean to say that the laws of extradition are abolished.
No, but the whole point about having a European arrest warrant is it makes quicker extradition within the European Union than it is anywhere else. And it also, you know, and obviously we can't so easily get the bad people that we may well want to get to this country, and we can't get access to all of the databases with the information that we need to that's shared across Europe about people's offences and all sorts of things.
So you think that in a no deal situation, that the European Union would actually say, well, you've decided to have no deal, so therefore we're not even going to talk about deals where it's in our mutual interest?
That there may well be in the longer term the ability to re-enter on some terms or another those provisions, but what immediately happens is that you no longer have access to those, and they are used thousands and thousands of times every day to keep us safe.
Well, I go back to a point that I've made before. If they really, in those circumstances, wanted to treat this country in that way, why would we want to be a member of an organisation that would do that?
It's like saying we're
going to make sure that you can't have any insulin or any life-saving drugs. I just cannot conceive that they would do that.
I think you're expressing the view which has been at the heart of the failure of the negotiations over the last 2 years, and that is, we're leaving, but they still really like us, and it's in their best interests to help us to do everything that we want to do.
It's not a case of helping.
Why would they? In fact, what has happened is
because
the
it's a two-way
has maintained
thing.
Great. Well, is it? I mean, how? I'll tell you what, the front of the newspapers in Europe today are not largely reporting Brexit because it ain't that important to them. We're leaving. They can completely successfully carry on without us as long as they maintain the integrity of the deal that they've done. They're not bothered about us. It's not even being sort of vicious to us or difficult to us. They just have more important things to worry about than whether or not we're now able to access the things which were part of the club that we've decided we want to leave.
You wait till John Redwood introduces the banning German car imports bill.
Right.
you say they don't need us. They actually do need us to trade with. And I know Remainers never like hearing this, but the trade imbalance is so big that they actually do need us. And I don't believe that in a no-deal situation... I've said all along that there would, of course, be short-term difficulties. I don't deny that at all. But to think that normal, sensible, intelligent people are going to try and punish this country by withholding drugs or chemicals that sort of enable us to have proper water. Well, let's see. Well, let's hope
there's
we don't have to see.
There's a legal basis for those. There's a legal basis for those arrangements, which will be removed by a no deal.
And they they're there already, and they can easily be renewed at the just a signature of a pen.
Well, I think you'll find that negotiation is a bit more tricky than you suggest.
Maybe. Yeah. Now, I want to ask you a question. When you were Chief Whip, did you buy off anyone with an honour?
No.
Or attempt to?
I didn't, because one, it's wrong, and two, it wouldn't have bloody well worked with Labour politicians either. I mean, quite a few of them have got sirs and ladies, but...
I happen to know that there was an occasion, I think you were, in fact, I'm pretty sure you were Home Secretary at the time, but you may not have been. It was on the... Gordon Brown was Prime Minister, so you must have been Home Secretary.
Yeah.
And there was it 90 days terror, something like that? Some legislation was going through the House, 42. And you were going to lose the vote, which I think you did, actually, didn't you?
Yes. We withdrew it.
I know a Labour MP that was called in. I don't know whether you were in the room or not, but was called into Gordon Brown's office in the House of Commons and was offered, shall we say, 5 or 6 different things to try to get him to vote. Now, I'll tell you off air who the Labour MP was, and you'll understand why he didn't accept any of them. But, I mean, don't pretend that it didn't happen under a Labour government.
Wait a minute. I didn't... Just a minute. I didn't say nobody got offered anything, Ian. I said...
Now we're getting to the truth.
I said it wouldn't have worked to have offered them a title. Of course, you know, it isn't as crude as, you know, if you vote with the government, you'll get X or Y. It's much more sophisticated than that. But of course, there are a whole range of...
It is absolutely true. This guy was offered a place on a particular committee. He was offered a chairmanship of a committee and all sorts of other things too.
No, I could imagine that happening. I'm not saying that didn't happen. Couldn't happen now, incidentally, of course, because the committees are elected by members of Parliament as opposed to being in the gift of the whips as they were then. But I mean, yes, no, people also came in negotiating things for their constituency and received...
Pork barrel politics.
Exactly, and received, if not cast iron guarantees, and certainly sort of warm words and the opportunity to talk to the relevant minister and all of that. Of course, all of that happens when you think what you're trying to do is sufficiently important to justify it. That is the truth of the matter. Most of the time what you're doing is you're trying to appeal to people's political sense or to make the case to them or to provide them with a way to be able to express their view and to have that accepted in some sort of way that doesn't destroy the decision or the piece of legislation you're trying to get through. So it's a lot more sophisticated than simply what do you want for your vote. But I accept that sometimes those deals are done. And of course, we spoke to the DUP at quite some length about their support for the terror legislation. We didn't bung them the sort of money that Theresa May's bunged them, which is another pretty bad... ranks alongside Boris's water cannon as badly spent.
I suspect that tap has just been turned off.
Indeed it has. And what was Boris doing at the DUP conference? Is this part of his leadership ambitions?
Well, Philip Hammond was there as well. So if you want to have a go at Boris, you have to have a go at Philip Hammond. I don't see any great problem with them speaking at that conference. It's not the first time politicians have been to different party conferences. But, I mean, I think going back to what we were talking about, because I know you're trying to get off that subject. But
I've been very open.
The reason...
I have broken the whips a murder by telling you as much as I've told you.
You have. John Hayes...
Bless him.
He got awarded a knighthood. Now, I was trying to remember the last time that someone was just out of the blue awarded a knighthood. And I can't remember when that happened because it normally happens in honours lists. And the only conclusion that I could come to was that he maybe didn't trust that the Prime Minister would still be there on the 31st of December. So he said, well, you better renounce it now. But on the other hand, he's apparently told Tory MPs today that he's going to vote against the deal. So all of this trouble for absolutely nothing.
Well, your piece, which if people haven't read it yet, they should read.
At iandale.com.
Thank you. Tells you what you need to know about the nature of John Hayes, who actually I've always got on very well with. The nature of the sort of... promises that he makes to a wide variety of people, and the reaction of his colleagues. That Marc Francois letter is absolutely, I mean, it's what my kids would call a bum stinger. It really is. It is absolutely vicious, and I don't fancy John's chances of getting much of a fond welcome when he walks into Parliament tomorrow, if that's the reaction of many.
No, I mean, I don't know. I do know John. In fact, I had a coffee with John Hayes a couple of weeks ago about something. And I've, as I say in the piece, I've known him since 2005. And just to relate an anecdote for those who haven't read what I wrote, on my first day as David Davis's chief of staff, this was at the end of May 2005, he came into the office and introduced himself because we'd never met before. And effectively said, well, he didn't effectively say, he did say, now, play your cards right. And if David does the right thing and says the right things, I mean, getting out of the European People's Party would be a good start. I can deliver 35 votes for him. And I just sort of nodded sagely and thought, yeah, right. Anyway, later that day, I was in Portcullis House and I saw John Hayes going to David Willetts's office, sort of on the second floor with my friend Mark Fox. Anyway, a few hours later, I saw Mark and I said, well, what was John Hayes doing with Willetts then? He said, oh, well, he was saying that he could deliver 35 votes for him. and that, you see, John Hayes likes to think himself as a real player, a bit of a Machiavellian figure who knows everything, knows where all the secrets are, master of the dark arts. But he's not quite as clever sometimes as he thinks he is. And for example, once I wrote that piece yesterday, another Tory MP texted me and he said, when we used to have cornerstone groups group meetings, which they were the shall we say the Kinder Kusha, what's the other one, the
Kucha.
Yeah, I'm trying to think of the German expression. Anyway, it's the three Ks, not the KKK, yeah. But family for flag. Those type of Tory MPs, they formed the Cornerstone Group, and John was fairly senior in that with Ian Duncan Smith, people like that. And they used to meet in a House of Commons committee room at 6 o'clock on a Wednesday evening. And this MP told me that virtually every week someone then spied John Hayes going into the Chief Whip's office at 7:10 each evening, essentially to snitch on what had been said in the meeting.
There you go. See?
There you go.
He's a man who keeps a range of friends close to him. That's why he's a wise Sir John.
He is a very entertaining character, but he has, shall we say, nobody could understand why he was made a senior advisor to David Cameron back in 2013. Everyone assumed that, I mean, he'd been a minister at the insistence of Ian Duncan Smith in 2010, and no one, every reshuffle, people thought, well, he can't last another one. Anyway, he did last right up until, was it this year or last year? And the reason that this MP thinks he was appointed an advisor to David Cameron was because he was getting all of that intel, and it was a bit of a payback, but we shall never know the truth of that, I suppose.
But there's a limit, you know, there is only a limited number of positions you can give people, reassurances you can provide for them, reviews you can offer them, tweaks to words you can give them. And I don't think that all of that will be happening, yeah. But there ain't enough of them to win round enough people to get this through Parliament.
Did you see Jeremy Hunt on Andrew Marr this morning?
I didn't, but I've heard good things.
He, I thought, was incredibly impressive. It's the best interview I've seen him do. And for the first time, I looked at him and I thought, I could imagine you as Prime Minister, which up until now, I'm not sure I could. I think he's really, really hit this job running. As Foreign Secretary, and sometimes, and I mean, he's a Health Secretary for 5 years, and I think sometimes you do need a change to sort of refresh yourself a bit. And yeah. I think this job has done in the world of good. Now, he was partly talking about the Matthew Hedges situation in the United Arab Emirates, which isn't it strange how every Brit always assumes that when another Brit is either imprisoned or charged or arrested in a foreign country, that they must automatically be innocent of the charges. Now, in this case, I think he probably is, but I do find this sort of quite an interesting phenomenon, because it does play into, I'm going to sound like Owen Jones in a minute, it does play into this thing that, well, we're better than everybody else, and therefore, of course, a British person is innocent, and therefore the government has to step in and do everything they can. Well, here, it does look as if he's been completely stitched up or whatever, and I suspect there will be some deal, because the UAE is a friendly government. We do enormous amounts of trade with them. We export export, I think, £13 billion worth of trade a year. They export about £5 billion to us. And obviously, there's a lot of UAE money sloshing around the country. So I suspect in the end, it'll all come right, unlike what's happened, of course, with Nazanin Zaghari Ratcliffe in Iran, where I think, again, Jeremy Hunt has done as much as he probably can and has made very clear he sees her as one of his big priorities in the job.
I think he's handled this quite carefully. I mean, you're right, but about what people feel about Brits, you know, caught in other countries' legal systems. But if you are the foreign secretary or a diplomat, you do have to be enormously careful. You know, you can't just say you're a bunch of shysters, let our guy out. I heard one of our former ambassadors to the UAE talking about it. And equally, if somebody is your ally, you have to find a way to enable them to do what you consider to be the right thing, which I have no doubt in this case would be let him go. But in a way that is in line with their country's procedures. And they do have this ability to show clemency when a request is made. And it looks to me as if quite a lot of work has gone into supporting his wife in making a request for clemency, allowing the UAE authorities to consider that. And I think people feel optimistic about it, which is why both Jeremy Hunt and others have said they feel that things are moving in, you know, careful language about things moving in the right direction. But that is, you know, that needs a bit of careful handling, which I'm afraid our former foreign secretary blatantly failed to show in the case that you're talking about in Iran. And I don't know, have you been watching this Inside the Foreign Office programme?
I saw the first one, I haven't seen the second one yet.
Well, the second one even more clearly demonstrates why Boris Johnson was a disaster as foreign secretary. You know, he just charges around the place, not demonstrating the intellect, which I think he must have to have got to where he has in his life. And you see the faces of the officials as they force themselves to sort of keep a straight face whilst briefing him or hearing what he's doing are something to behold. And then they have the moment when Jeremy Hunt becomes the foreign secretary. And, you know, obviously it's probably partly in the editing, but the only bit you've seen of him so far is him looking serious and asking a sensible question. So there is a real clear contrast between them. Jeremy Hunt is undoubtedly helped by the contrast with Boris Johnson, but he's a serious politician. You know, don't survive reasonably unscathed as he did as the Secretary of State for Health without having something about you. And he was not, you know, he wasn't popular as in the NHS, but he wasn't half as unpopular as some others could have been or have been.
Now, last week we had a bit of a go at Shami Chakrabarty, didn't we? And we thought we'd make that a regular thing. Not having
a go
at her.
I thought we were quite nice about her, but you're right, others viewed it differently.
Yeah. Did you get any comeback from that?
No.
No one was listening, probably. So we thought we'd have a regular. We can't call it Bitch of the Week because that would be the wrong title. But it's sort of us having a bitch about somebody rather than the person themselves.
Yeah. We can call it that because it is the verb to bitch. That's
exactly. But we're going to have to explain that every week if it's a woman, aren't we? So anyway, this week it isn't a woman. And we've unanimously agreed that we're going to have a bitch about Owen Jones, aren't we?
Bless him.
Who I really like and always have done. Always got on really well with him. But he doesn't half wind me up sometimes. I was going to DM him about something on Twitter yesterday. And I suddenly discovered that he didn't follow me anymore. And I thought, well, that's a bit insulting. So I just tweeted, the moment when you go to DM Owen Jones and you find out he's not following you. That. Well, the heavens descended on him. And a lot of people, well, hundreds, if not thousands of people said, well, he blocks everyone. Apparently, according to Guido Fawkes, he's been mass deleting tweets. Don't know why he would do that. Anyway, he rather piously came on and replied today saying, well, having seen all the comments from your lovely followers, Ian, I didn't want to bring down the quality of them. I thought, you little sod. And the point is, I have some obnoxious followers. I don't mind admitting that. But so does everybody. Particularly if you're in the public eye, and particularly if you are in politics or associated with politics on one side or the other, there are probably people who follow you that you'd rather that didn't. And if I find people doing things that I regard as unacceptable, fine, I'll block them. But he seems to block everybody that he doesn't agree with. So he didn't like that very much. And I just think, well, grow up, mate.
Owen's problem, I mean, you know, Owen has written some really interesting books. He has some interesting, sophisticated ideas from the left about what should happen in British politics. He essentially let himself down when he, because remember, he was one of the people at the time when there was a lot of concern over Jeremy Corbyn, who said he thought that Jeremy Corbyn should go. And he's essentially been trying to get that back ever since, because he sort of lost some of his traction with the current leadership of the Labour Party. He doesn't have, it feels to me that he doesn't quite have the media profile that he had at one point either, because there are others. You know, he was one of the first people who might be seen as sort of part of the, dare I call it, New Labour, but not New Labour, sort of people who was getting quite a lot of media coverage. Now there are plenty of others who can do that as well, so he gets less. In that way, I feel sorry for him. But you're right, he certainly blocks and unfollows loads of people. I was just going to check, actually, if he follows me. He did at one point.
That will really get you spluttering.
Then I kind of decide if I want to carry on being nice about him or not. Oh no, mind you, I don't follow him either. So there.
Oh, he doesn't follow you. So he's unfollowed.
Doesn't follow me.
He's unfollowed you as well.
I don't know if he's ever followed me, but he doesn't follow me. He isn't following me at the moment. But then, as I say, I'm not following him because I did find him a bit irritating. But there is something about Twitter as well that does facilitate pile-ins, and sometimes people bring it, sort of encourage it, and sometimes it just happens. But you do have a responsibility, if you've got the sort of following that he's got or that you've got, Ian, to be careful that you don't encourage even unexplicitly your followers to sort of go in on somebody really hard just because you disagree.
No, that is true, and I have noticed that's happened on occasion before, and I'm always quite careful. I say always, if I think about it, I'm quite careful with people who are just sort of random members of the public who have a go at me, because I think if you're not used to it, having hundreds of strangers descend on you and call you all the names under the sun, I mean, it's not a pleasant experience. Just before we go to a few questions, it was the centenary of the legislation allowing women in Parliament this week, last week.
It was indeed, and the Women and Equality Committee had a really impressive range of people, including Nan Sloan from Labour Women's Network and Sarah Childs, who is the Professor of Politics at Birkbeck, Sam Smethers from the Fabian Society, giving evidence about the current difficulties for women getting into Parliament. It was also, of course, an opportunity, because at least two of those have written in the Honourable Ladies, Ian. It was also an opportunity for us to remind people that if you are doing your Christmas shopping and you have women or men in your family who are interested in politics and political stories, getting them a copy of Volume 1 of the Honourable Ladies to put by their bed and dip in and read some absolutely brilliant stories about the women elected as MPs between 1918 and 1996. This is your opportunity to do it. And it's a great Christmas present. So there you go. I'm helping you out with your Christmas shopping.
It is a great Christmas present, and we'll have another one along next week, next year for Christmas as well. It's amazing. We had 323 essays to commission for Volume 2, and we've only got 30 to go. So if anybody wants to do that, just Google Ian Dale Honourable Ladies, and you should come up with a blog post where it tells you what you need to do, or just send me an email, or indeed send Jackie an email as well, because we want to wrap all those up by Christmas, I suppose. Now, let's move on to some questions. Matthew Holbert says, if you were Prime Minister and public opinion was not a factor, what new law would you bring in, banning the word so at beginning of sentences?
Have we done this? We did this before, didn't I? Because I said, wasn't I going to do having a go at people for bad spelling, I think?
I mean, seriously, we ought to really be able to instantly name 10 laws that we'd like to bring in, or 10 laws that we'd like to abolish. The one at the moment that I have a real bee in my bonnet about is retrospective taxation, this loan charge thing where ordinary people who were advised to follow a particular tax scheme, which is approved by HMRC, are now being stung for tax going back 20 years. Now, I think if you haven't paid your taxes, the Inland Revenue should go after you. But I've always thought that is it 6 or 7 years that is normally the maximum amount of time they can go back? back, and people are being chased for like £100,000-£150,000, and it is so inequitable. There was a debate on it in the House of Commons this week, and I think the government are going to have to U-turn on it, because all political parties have got agree that this is wrong and they should not be doing it. And it also emerged this week that HMRC have been paying their own contractors under the same scheme, can you believe?
I would change the law to get rid of Andrew Lansley's NHS reforms and enable health organisations to do what largely they are getting on and doing, which is to work actually much more closely together and to get rid of the bureaucracy and competition that his legislation brought in.
And he also says, Jackie, were there any times as Chief Whip where you were fundamentally opposed to the legislation you were whipping your party colleagues to support?
There weren't. I mean, I have voted for things that I felt uneasy about in my time. But the argument I always used to use to people was, you know, there's no difficulty in voting for things you support. The challenge of collective responsibility and action in a political party is to vote for things that perhaps you personally wouldn't have agreed with, but which the collective has decided is the right thing to do.
Sam Amsler says, what will the title of your memoirs be? Hoping they're grammatically correct, he says. have you ever been tempted to write your memoirs?
Not really, no. In fact, I've sort of criticised. I should have been, because one of the points that Nan Sloan, who I just mentioned, makes very strongly about women in politics is they are very bad at telling their own story. So what women don't tend to do is to collect together their papers and, you know, lodge them in academic institutions and things like that. They're not as likely to write their memoirs as some men. You know, I used to sit around the cabinet table with colleagues taking notes, and I was absolutely certain that they weren't taking notes so they could go back and share the information with their ministerial team. They were taking notes for their bloody memoirs, and it used to drive me up the wall. What I should have done is to take notes myself, but I'm afraid I didn't. I was a bit busy running a department and trying to not lose a marginal seat at the time.
It is a good question, because I think the title of a politician's memoirs often says quite a lot about them. Some of them, like Tony Blair, was it My Journey or A Journey?
A Journey.
I thought, yeah. Oh my God, that sounded like sort of my struggle almost, didn't it? I remember having discussions when I published John Knott's book, where he wanted to have some grandiose title. I said, no, there's only one title for your memoirs, and it's Here Today, Gone Tomorrow, because of his famous walk out of that interview with Robin Day. And similarly, Bill Rogers, I had to almost insist that his book, I mean, what is Bill Rogers best known for? Because a lot of people who are listening to this podcast will never have heard of him, but he was one of the Gang of Four that formed the SDP. So, and he was the least well known of them. So I came up with the title Fourth Among Equals, which was a Geoffrey Archer book, First Among Equals. So, but he's a very proud man, and he really didn't want to call it that, but in the end saw the logic of it. It was one of the best books ever published, actually. So I'm trying to think of a self-deprecating title for either of us, but all the ones I come up with for you are probably best left unsaid.
And I can't come up with any. You know, I should do more bloody homework before these podcasts, because people ask really brilliant questions, and then I sort of go, oh, I'm not sure. I don't know. It would have to be something like, you know, doing her best, or you know,
dear, how would
that, vaguely getting by, or.
I think mine would probably be, what would you like to say? Which is what I always say to callers when they call in. So that's the nearest I got to a catchphrase, I suppose. Noah says, excluding LBC, what is your favourite global radio station? Well, if I want to creep to my boss, I have to say Heart, because he runs that as well. But if I'm honest, it's probably Radio X.
Classic's one of yours, isn't it?
Yeah.
Can I choose that then?
Classic? You can. I don't really do classical music, because I'm a cultural philistine.
True.
There were lots of these questions we've really covered on the Brexit front, so I'm not going to go through those.
Just on the cultural philistine front, and I know we're supposed to be doing questions and not going on too long. Did you see Bjorn from ABBA on Mar this morning?
I could have cried because I got a call on Wednesday from the Mar people saying, would you like to review the papers this week? So I said, yeah, it's fine, I'm around. So I didn't know who else was going to be on. Anyway, on Friday, they said, we've had a bit of a rejig, so we don't need you on Sunday after all. So
they had Andrew Pearce instead,
yeah,
lovely.
They had Andrew Pearce because, of course, he appeared in Mamma Mia in a, just for one night or something, in a sort of minor role. And I texted the producer this morning. I said, I can't believe you've had Bjorn from ABBA on and dropped me for Andrew Pearce. I'm their biggest fan. I've got every bootleg, every mega mix that they've ever done. But a nice thing did happen on the music front this week, because Cliff Richard came in to LBC to do an interview with Steve Allen. And Sod's Law, I wasn't there because it was at 12 o'clock in midday. Anyway, I get into LBC about one, and Steve Allen was still there. And I don't normally see him because obviously he's at the other end of the day. And he immediately rushed over to me and he said, Cliff wanted me to tell you how appreciative he was about that blog post you wrote about him. Which, if you haven't seen it, it is on my website, In Praise of Cliff Richard, I think it's called. And because I do think I love his music, and I think he's had the most terrible time, totally undeservedly. And then later in the day, Steve's producer came up with a bottle of rosé wine from Cliff's vineyard called Congratulations, with a little note from Cliff. So my cup ranneth over.
That is lovely.
Even though I don't drink rosé wine. So
give me a glass. I'll try it for you.
Paul Nolan says, given the talk of heraldic crests, what would someone put on yours?
I think I should have something like a cat. I could have Pussy Rampant on one side.
And, and an utter cock on the other. Which, if people haven't seen the John Hay stuff, they won't get and think I'm being smutty, no. Which, of course, I wouldn't dream of being.
Of course not. This is totally heraldic of you, Ian.
Would you have a bath plug on it?
Well, I wouldn't have a porn movie on it, would I?
That's the Evening Standard diary sorted out for this week. Have you noticed? Well, of course, you don't see it. But
they love us. No, but no, they do. See bits of it, yeah.
No, every week. Yeah. So it's, but then
they pay us a bloody fee.
Well, the little sods often don't even mention the podcast. They just sort of say, oh, Jackie Smith or Ian Dale, which is fine, but it'd be nice if they mentioned the podcast. Hint.
Because if they don't mention the podcast... If they don't mention the podcast, it makes it sound like we're just wandering around saying things for no good reason.
I mean, fair enough. I'd have to have a Jack Russell on, wouldn't I? Not just because of
you
Dude,
would.
But also the one on Brighton Beach, I suppose. What else would I have?
And then on the other side, you could have a prone man.
In so many
standing
ways.
Standing over him.
And Lord Castle of Aston says, I'm preempting the Villa win. Well, they did actually win. Was it 5-1 or 4-1 today? Did Jackie get the chance to watch the match, and how good was it to beat the Blues? And would she ever sit on the Villa board if they offered her a seat? Up the Villa.
Absolutely. Would I? Yeah, I probably would, actually, given half a chance. I didn't get to go to the match, I'm afraid, not least because I was recording this with you. I don't go. I've just been talking to my boys about what match we'll go to around Christmas, and I think we're going to see if we can get tickets for the Leeds match. But if greatness was thrust upon me, I would perfectly willingly give my services to Aston Villa. Obviously not on the pitch.
No.
Although, having said that...
You do your servicing in the dressing room. I think that is a wonderful way to end. So it just remains for me to tell you that the Ian Dale Book Club podcast, we've had a couple of corkers on that this week. Mary Portis has been in to visit. One of the best interviews I think I've ever done, I have to say. And Barbara Hosking and Stanley Underhill, who you won't know, but they're both 92 and they've both come out as gay and they've written their memoirs, and both absolutely brilliant books. I'm also interviewing James O'Brien on Wednesday for an hour about his book, which has gone to number 6 in the Amazon charts, which is an amazing achievement. So I'm quite looking forward to that. We have Cross Question on Wednesday at 8 o'clock on LBC. Keith Simpson MP will be there. Gavin Shuker, Dame Louise Casey is going to be on the panel. And Matt Zarb cousin as well, so that should be quite a good one too. I will also be on LBC from Monday to Thursday from 7 until 10. We have Nadeem Zahawi coming in, the Children's Minister, on Tuesday for an hour at 8 to take calls. A lot of people want to talk about special needs education, so that's your chance to call in to speak to him. So it's goodbye from me.
Goodbye.
Bye.
Is that your sexy voice?
I haven't got a sexy voice.
No, clearly.
Anyway, enough is enough.
Enough is enough is enough is enough.
I can't go. No. Oh dear, that was embarrassing.
Yeah, I can't go.
I think you should cut that out, Julia.